Hello, I'm Lino Khmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will have an in-depth conversation on antimicrobial resistance with Professor Murphy Mpundu, director of the think tank React Africa. But first, did you know that spending time outdoors could greatly improve our mental and physical well-being? That's according to studies in the National Library of Medicine. The experts say nature can help improve our mental health and help decrease our anxiety levels, stress, and feelings of anger. Nature can also help improve our physical wellness by reducing cortisol levels and muscle tension, among other things. Now, a long-term study suggests that spending time in green spaces or by water can help prevent heart disease. VOA's Dora Mekua has more.
City living with limited access to green spaces or bodies of water is bad for your heart, according to a study analysis from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine.
Heart recipients with limited access to these spaces, particularly those living in a lower economic neighborhoods, right, had higher odds of developing coronary artery calcification.
Coronary artery calcification can be an early sign of heart disease, which can lead to a heart attack. The long-term study found that the association was most pronounced in Black people living in lower-income neighborhoods. On the other hand, access to nature actually has health effects that can slow down the biological aging process.
This beneficial environment also have better oxygen, cleaner air. But I think the most important thing is to promote their social interaction to be physically active. And all these factors can promote your immune system.
We're going to get a little closer to the water.
The study results come as no surprise to Heidi Schreiber-Pan, a Maryland-based therapist who often conducts client sessions in natural settings.
There's so much evidence to support that when the human body is in connection with the natural world, that our sympathetic nervous system is lower, lower blood pressure. So the body responds so well to the calming environment of the bird song, sound of water, the trees.
The study followed almost 3,000 people for 25 years, from around 1985 until 2011. The study authors concluded that being outdoors often means people are exercising more, which is good for heart health.
Asking yourself that and seeing what comes for you.
That makes perfect sense to Schreiber-Pan.
When humans are outdoors, which is our original habitat, we tend to be more physically active, is what the human body needs. So there's so many like cardiovascular benefits to that, just being more active. But then there's also all that other benefit of just the sounds of nature, water and birds, right?
Study author Howe says her analysis provides scientific evidence that it would be beneficial for governments and city planners to find ways to improve access to quality green and blue spaces, especially in economically deprived neighborhoods. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
Gwen Freed is a horticultural therapist at the Glass Garden at NYU Medical Center and Project Find Senior Center in New York City. She discusses some of the health benefits of nature and how live plants can positively impact our well-being.
I think, first of all, we all learned in science class when we were young that plants clean the air, plants add oxygen to the air, they regulate humidity. But there's a body of research that also proves that being in an environment with plants, a nice area in your town, that it improves pride and a feeling of safety. Therapeutic horticulture is the use of or the engagement of a client, a patient, or a resident in a facility in a nature-based activity that is facilitated by a trained therapist, someone who understands how to use the benefits of nature to their advantage. With any therapeutic relationship, one of the most important things is the rapport and the relationship that the therapist has with the person they're working with. That's when a well-trained, educated therapist will know how to attain that that relationship, to build that rapport. And once that is there, the practitioner will be able to harness the benefits of nature, the calming, the blood pressure reduction, the heart rate reduction, harness that and design a program or an activity to best meet the needs of their patient. And it could be any patient of any age. The program here at NYU Langone Health, it has been in the hospital in some form since the early 70s. And what we do is we provide horticulture and nature-based activities to our rehabilitation patients. Now, we work alongside physical, occupational, and speech therapists doing co-treatments. And very often, that is honing in exactly on the motivation I was talking to you about before. Sometimes it's hard for people to see why they would do something if they're not seeing results quickly enough. And if you can intersperse a nature-based activity where they can see that they're doing something familiar. I think the biggest thing that we can see as a benefit of therapeutic horticulture is the fact that we as healthcare professionals need to treat the whole patient. Humans are not a car where it gets a flat and you fix the flat and the car goes on its way. They are very intertwined. Their mind, their body, all of those things work together. And you have to realize that when you put somebody in a situation where they're in a stressful, maybe life-threatening, maybe something has changed dramatically in their life, and they have to reassess so many things, that being able to incorporate nature into that, to be able to see life around you and see that there's a hope for the future, is very important, because it does, as I said before, put things into perspective. Nature is far greater than all of us. It was here before us, and hopefully if we don't screw things up too badly, it will be here after us. And to be able to bring that to people who probably need it the most, people who can't access it on their own, is very important.
We turn now to antimicrobial resistance. New forecasts from the Global Research on Antimicrobial Resistance, GRAM project, suggest that bacterial antimicrobial resistance, AMR, will cause 39 million deaths between 2025 and 2050. That's 3 deaths every minute. Published in the Lancet Global Burden of Bacterial Antimicrobial Resistance, 1990, to 2021, a systematic analysis with forecasts to 2050. The annual mortality increase attributed to bacterial AMR is projected to rise from 1.14 million in 2021 to an estimated 1.91 million in 2050. Bacterial antimicrobial resistance occurs when bacteria change in a way that makes them no longer respond to medicines. For more insight, I spoke with Professor Murfin Mpundu, Director of REACT Africa. Take a listen.
Antimicrobial resistance includes viruses. It does include bacteria. It includes parasites and fungi. These cause infections, in both human beings and in animals. And the one that is, one of the major issues, of course, and the focus is really antibiotic resistance. And antibiotic resistance simply is where the bacteria develops a way to survive in the presence of a medicine that once slowed its growth or destroyed it. So when we talk about really antimicrobial resistance, we are broadening resistance to these other organisms that cause infections in both human beings, in animals, but also, in other species in the food systems.
The global research on antimicrobial resistance, GRAM, provide a comprehensive analysis of the global AMR burden over time. What did you find most concerning about the report as it relates to sub-Saharan Africa?
This report actually has highlighted a number of things. It builds up from a report that was they released in 2019. The 2019 report, as relates to Africa, the data for 2019 was showing that we were losing 255,000, people were dying deaths in the region because of antimicrobial resistance. And what this study has done, it has looked at a longer period, but also provided a forecast for us looking at what would happen until about 2050. So from 2025 up to 2050, we're looking at that, there will be 30.35 million deaths in sub-Saharan Africa, and these will be associated with AMR. Looking at about 6.63 million of these will be directly attributable to AMR. What this actually, translates to in the region is that sub-Saharan Africa really accounts for a region that is disproportionately affected by global AMR deaths. And when we look at a particular resistance, for example, in TB, where we've got mouth drug tuberculosis, these are really organisms that cause TB, and they are resistant to a number, more than two, three, four drugs that they once responded to. We're looking at a very glaring picture. To break it down even further is that the current deaths that we are seeing from malaria and HIV, when we combine them, they are far less than the deaths that are being caused or attributed to actually antimicrobial resistance. And so this is a very concerning, and it's an awakening call that we need to do something, as this is becoming really a leading cause of death in the African region.
What are some of the health system gaps in the region that make it particularly vulnerable to the rapid spread of AMR?
That's an excellent question. There are a number of factors. One of the things we have to look at the driving fact, drivers of AMR in the region. One of the drivers of AMR in the region is that, we have unrestricted and unregulated access to antibiotics that are available on the market. In many of these countries, you can buy them, from the market. You can buy them from, a registered pharmacy or chemist without a prescription. And so the easy access has allowed us to misuse this particular product. There's also a misuse that happens in the animal industry. When we look at, poultry, We actually are using a lot of these molecules not to treat, but as growth promoters. And so that's one driver. The second driver that we have is that, we've got very fragile and very weak health systems that are underinvested in. And this is quite common, where you would have a patient walking into a health system, they will be seen. The laboratory infrastructure or the lab may not exist, where we can actually draw a specimen and try and identify what is causing the infection in this particular patient. And then, if we have that, we may not have the drugs in the pharmacy. And so they end up not having those in the pharmacy. And so what happens is that we start over-relying on a few antibiotics that, we actually speed or we actually catalyze that sort of, movement towards the bacteria developing resistance. The other areas, that we have not invested in prevention of infections largely. When you look at the Sustainable Development Goal, that looks at, clean water and sanitation hygiene, we haven't invested. We've got one in two hospitals in any city you walk into, including capital cities in the African region, that have no drop of of water coming out of those taps. You will find buckets of water. You would find that we are doing procedures in these hospitals, but if you don't have clean running water, we've not invested in hygiene. What we are doing is that these drug-resistant organisms, they move fast, and the hospital is an incubator for them. And so, we face very, very, fast spread. And quickly, what we see in a hospital is a reflection of the community that we are coming from. And I always say, tell me about your hospital and I'll tell you what the community is. If you are telling me that the hospital has got no running water, and I've visited so many of these hospitals across the African region, it means that in the community, we are not investing to prevent infections. We're in the communities, because these infections are coming from the communities, and then we get those patients into the hospital. So we need to prevent. We look at our water, sanitation, hygiene, vaccinations, ensuring that we can prevent infections rather than focusing on the curative side.
Prevention is key, as you just mentioned. So if we want to look at the issue of access to prevent with clean water, sanitations, there are communities that don't have access to those preventative steps. Yeah. What about treatment? What about cure? What is possible in terms of solution?
The first thing that we have to do is we have enough data that is showing us, AMI is really a critical and, it's a major global, national, subnational threat. It is not only affecting lives. We are losing many lives that we should not be losing. We are also at the same time, economically, we are pushing more people into poverty, because when they are sick, they cannot work, they get fired, they are spending more money on healthcare. We have we have health systems that are broken. So one of the things we need to do is that we need a larger commitment from our leaders in the African region that can focus and say, let us invest in health systems. One of the things that we have is that there's very little surveillance that is happening in the region. There are very few labs that are able, that are functional or that even exist. So we're looking at that, when you look at other studies that have come out, you'll see that most of the labs actually can't even, the consumables are not available. And we have not trained our workforce, to respond and to react to changes that will come. So the first thing is that, there has to be a national commitment, a regional commitment, and a commitment towards really strengthening health systems. What has happened over the last few years is that we have made a drugstore the first point of care, where, if somebody's sick, they will not go to a clinic. When some of us were growing up, those years, the first point of care was a primary health care, which was a clinic. And then you were referred to higher levels of care, but that doesn't exist anymore. And, the lack of investment, the declining in investment in healthcare systems is one of the factors that, as long as our health systems are broken, we don't have the staff, we don't have laboratories, we don't have reagents, we don't have the medicines, we cannot train our staff, with the changes and with the best evidence available, we can't respond. And that begins with our governments taking that commitment and then bringing all the partners together to work together to really strengthen these sort of health systems and address what is systemic countries.
It's time for a short break. We'll have more of my conversation with Professor Murphy Mpundu, Director of REACT Africa. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. If you are just joining us, we are discussing antimicrobial resistance with Professor Murphy Mpundu, Director of REACT Africa. Here is more on our conversation.
Many people do not realize the impact of antimicrobial resistance on health systems and what causes it as well. Let's take the example of maybe counterfeit drugs or even access to prescription medicine like antibiotics.
One of the challenges that we have is that whenever we have a good product, it's a recipe to have a bad product. So there are quite a number of factors, so when there's a market for antibiotics that are quality assured, there will be a market of actually falsified. There will be a market of, products that, that will not meet the quality. That's the reality of life. So how do you address things like that? One of the things that we have tried to do in the African region has been, the fact that we think that regulation is a single silver bullet that solves everything. Regulation on its own is not going to solve this problem, because all these countries, where you're from, where I'm from originally from Zambia, we have these regulations. But in any of these countries, you still will be able to, have access to these, products. So how do we address it? So one, we need to bring a number of interventions up together that will support each other and reinforce. Regulation is one of them. We need to raise awareness in the communities. We need to build capacity and raise knowledge, not only just among healthcare workers. We have to do that in the community. People are starting to understand. We need to build that health literacy level. What are antibiotics? What does it mean if we misuse them? What does resistance mean? People should know what the consequences of this, and and they will make responsible decisions. We need to ensure that we strengthen the health systems, because what we have is a lack of confidence in health systems. Why should I go into a hospital and spend 6 hours? I'll not have an X-ray done. They'll tell me that they cannot do any labs. At the end of the day, they'll tell me that, they don't have any medicines for me. One of the chronic problems we have in our health systems in the African region is that is a chronic problem of stockouts. Stockouts are a reality. And so even when we are seeing with antibiotics, there are so many times the first line treatment, the second line treatment are not available.
What do you mean by stockout? Unavailability of products?
Unavailability of, of medicines in hospitals in the country. So what we see being misused in markets, it's not the full story. The full story shows you that, when you look at the basic antibiotics, they are not in most hospitals at all. So that's one of the things that causes people to lose confidence and to go to, the drugstores. And sometimes, physicians, their hands are tied because they want to do the right thing. They want to prescribe something. It's not available. And they look at the patient and they say, this patient, even if I send them home with a prescription, they are not going to buy it. So what am I going to do? I'll give them anything I have, even if I know it's not going to work. We have to be able, to address these issues. We have to be able to invest in laboratory infrastructure. Why? Because we have to know the organisms we are dealing with. If we don't know the bacteria we are dealing with, we don't know which antibiotics they are resistant to, we will continue in the situation we are in because we are treating things that we do not know. We need that sort of evidence, and that evidence is important. So investing really in strong, resilient health systems is going to be key, and ensuring that the interventions are actually broader than just focusing on one intervention on regulation. That one itself will not work, but it's bringing and realizing that, empowering people, empowering our clinical staff, empowering our regulators, being able to generate the data, being able to look at that data that's very context specific, looking at the resistant patterns and being able to respond to that, I think that is the way to go forward.
And finally, before we wrap, Professor, what for you are one or two key takeaways from the global research on antimicrobial resistance?
The first thing is that it does show us that we are really what we have feared, what we have known, and some of us who have worked in this area for many years, what we keep talking about is the reality, and it's even worse. And if we don't do anything today, and if we don't seize the moment, for example, of the UNGA, you know, the high-level meeting that is coming, if we don't seize those moments to bring a global solidarity, to be able to bring our global leaders to, you know, to look at this issue, focus on it, try and look at the evidence, and try and see how we can respond together as a global community in addressing it, I think, you know, we will miss an opportunity. But secondly, you know, what this shows is that there are interventions we can do that are going to be really much of a game changer, and where there are low-hanging fruits. If we invest in prevention, we invest in ensuring that communities, hospitals have clean and safe running water, we invest in sanitation, in hygiene, and we really focus on, you know, ensuring that, you know, our vaccinations, we are doing, you know, that we are meeting the targets for vaccination, ensuring every human being, every child, every elderly patient gets the vaccines that they need. We are going to really prevent a lot of this infection and slow down the, you know, this rapid rate and this volcano we are seeing erupt in front of us of AMR. So it does show me those two things that, you know, we really on one hand really have to really come together, but it also gives us evidence that just by investing, you know, in prevention, in these interventions I've talked about, in, you know, and also really in strengthening our health systems, we can make a great change. And we can save many lives that we are losing today, and we are going to lose if we do nothing. And I think that's quite a threatening situation to look at.
You co-founded React Africa. Why was it important to start such a project focusing on antimicrobial resistance?
It was important. As early as 2008, we had started seeing that antibiotic resistance was becoming an issue in the African region. We had seen that there were patients that were not responding, and we were losing lives because they had drug-resistant infections. They had infections where the causing bacteria could not respond to the antibiotics that we had. And we already were seeing that trend, especially in children under 5, but also we saw that trend in the elderly patients. So we had the first call to action that we brought a few organizations together in Tanzania, Arusha, where we focused on trying to call the global community to the issue of AMR. That that culminated into us picketing at the World Health Assembly in 2009 to say, you know, there was a major issue we're dealing with, and we needed the, you know, a collective action to address antibiotic resistance, because we were failing to treat patients as clinical teams and clinical staff in institutions. React Africa has been an organization that has three strings. It is a think tank, it is a research institution, and it has been an implementing agency. It has supported many countries in the African region develop their national action plans, which are national strategies to address antimicrobial resistance. It has invested heavily in working with countries to strengthen their stewardship, prevention of infections in health systems, and also strengthening surveillance, as it were. It has also an organization that has brought major, you know, the Global South perspective and the Global South truth and experience to the global community to be able to see and to hear it from the first hand rather than. And so it has been an advocacy group. It has been able to really advocate for the African region, and it does continue to do that.
That was Professor Murphyn Mpundu, Director of React Africa. That's That's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu, in Washington, with producer Mukbil Yabaru. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.